live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Showdown in the NBA. Golden State v. Denver, the best team in the West, versus the Golden State Warriors. At least, that's what it said from a record standpoint. Denver went into last night with the best record in the West, having won 12 straight at home. And like Golden State a few years back, they're the team that nobody saw coming. I mean, this team just missed the playoffs last year. And for the first half of this year, they've been the best team in the best conference. They've got a legit MVP candidate. They barely had their starting five together. What I'm saying is they are legit. Denver is legit. And then last night, they ran into a legit buzzsaw. Golden State dropped 51 on their heads. Not in the first half, in the first quarter. A new NBA record for points in a single quarter. Yeah, you guys have got the best record in the West. Here's a 50 spot, a 50 piece, and one. Golden State comes out. They hit 10 threes in the first quarter. They ended that game immediately. So that showdown turned into a beatdown. Final score, 142-111. Golden State just beat the team with the best record in the West by 31 in their own house. Steph Curry, 31. Klay Thompson, 31. Kevin Durant, 27. Draymond Green, 13 assists. And yes, the game had the usual ridiculousness, like Curry taking threes from an entirely different zip code.
You know what he wants.
Oh, he backed up on Jokic. Oh! That was from Colorado Springs!
But that was not just about the threes. Last night was not just about Curry, and it was not just about Golden State burying Denver from deep. It was also about Klay, Alexander, Thompson. And it was not about his threes. It was about his filthy, filthy dunks. Now, as you know, Klay is a shooter. He is not a dunker. And as you probably know, everybody lets him know about that. Except last night, he put the entire league on notice. He put the entire world on notice. You knew there was something different about Golden State last night when this happened in the first quarter.
Free throw. Klay around Jokic. Oh, Klay Thompson! A right-hand hammer!
Throw it down, big man! That wasn't a hammer. That was the entire hardware store. Hey-o. Draymond Green reacts like Draymond sees that and he reacts like they just got another ring. That's how rare a Klay Thompson dunk is. The first dunk of the night was only his eighth of the season. He's had games with more threes than he has total dunks the entire year. A few days back, he scored 43 on a total of four dribbles. In other words, he does not mess around with dunks. The ball goes into his hands and into the hole from long range. Except last night. Last night, my guy turned into Dominique Wilkins. My man threw down not one, not two, not three, but four dunks in a single night. Roll the montage.
Free throw. Klay around Jokic. Oh, Klay Thompson. Thompson's got to beat Jokic. He went to try to swipe.
Yeah, and you don't want to look back and Klay gets a little.
Denver has emptied the bench. Klay with a steal. Klay, four dunks in a game. And the bench is going nuts.
Stephen Curry and Kevin Durant are out near the free throw line.
That last one was the absolute best. That last dunk was so great. Pay special attention to that final dunk. Because the best part is not the four dunks. It's the fact that after the fourth dunk, Klay was raising the roof repeatedly. Golden State bench was practically at midcourt celebrating. And then after the game, he was still fired up. He was so amped, he couldn't even remember what he said when he was texting trash talk to former teammate Zaza Pachulia about their dunk competition. He even actually started to text him once again during the post-game interview.
That was nice, man. I felt better than hitting 10 threes, to be honest.
Did you get a chance to talk some trash out with Zaza? Or?
Yeah, he texted me right after the game, said he's never seen me have four dunks. I told him I've never seen him. I don't know. I said something good, but he was right there to let me know that he saw the bounce for once.
You know what the dunk counter between you two is?
I got to be winning this year.
It's 11-1.
Ha! Good. I'm going to text him that right now, actually. You have one dunk. I have 11 this year. Pay me.
Pay me. He was impressed. He should be. except now Kevin Durant. Kevin Durant now was not nearly as impressed with Klay Thompson as Klay Thompson was impressed with Klay Thompson.
Enjoy the Klay dunk show out there.
Not much, because dunks don't look that good.
How much is he talking right now after the dunk show?
He's excited about those, probably his last four dunks of the year, though.
They tell him they got to be a little prettier?
Yeah, they kind of greased, he greased those in. He's 6'7", he should be jumping a little higher than that.
He's 6'7", he should be jumping a little higher than that. I don't know, my man had four. And more importantly, for anybody who doubted, last night, they look like the old Warriors. Not the Warriors being old. Hey-o. They were having fun. They were sharing the ball. They were absolutely shredding a very good team. Hey, but don't get it twisted. To a man, the Warriors were very clear that they were not looking to make a statement. Draymond Green to NBC Sports Bay Area, quote, "Nah, we don't have to remind them. They know." Durant to the world, quote, "They know who we are," end quote. All right. That said, still a statement. Maybe not a statement meant for Denver. Maybe it was a statement meant for anybody else who thought they saw weakness in the Warriors. You know, the people who thought their chemistry was off. You've heard all the raps. Their chemistry is off. Draymond Green's not physically right. They can't get back to being Golden State until Draymond is right. Yeah, maybe last night was not for the Warriors or for the Nuggets or for any other NBA team. Or maybe it was. Or maybe it was for anybody who thought that these guys were cracking and the dynasty was over. I'm not going to say that Golden State's back because they never left. But I'll say this. Playing the best team in the West, the Warriors played their most complete game of the season. And now they've got Boogie Cousins making his debut on Friday night. Uh-oh!
Uh-oh!
In other words, it is still Golden State and everybody else. They are still the team to beat.
Ha.
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 You have one. I have 11. Ha. Pay me. Ha. Ha. John Rahm is my guest. John, great to have you on. How are you?
Good. How are you, Jim?
Good. Good, John. So you had a top 10 finish at the Century Tournament of Champions in Hawaii. Now you're right back at it this week in La Quinta, where you won last year, John. How does your game feel right now?
Feeling very good. It's been very nice to have a little bit of a break after Hawaii and get to swing back to non-30-mile-an-hour wind golf.
That helps.
Very enjoyable and very, very ready for this week.
All right, so what about this week? As I mentioned, you are the defending champ there. So does it feel like there's added pressure because of that, or maybe is it a little bit easier because you know that track and you know you've won there in the past?
I don't think there's added pressure, only if you put it on yourself. The one thing that shows is that, you know how to win in this golf course. So unless there's a major difference, like the weather being extremely different or one of the courses that we play changing, you should have the self-confidence that, you can win there and you don't need to know anything special to win.
John Rahm, my guest, I'm looking back at your last year and it was a fascinating year in the sense that you had three wins, you had a Ryder Cup win, but you did it all over the world. You won in La Quinta, Madrid, Paris, and the Bahamas. As somebody who prides himself on being a player that can play anywhere in the world, how good did it feel to win all over the world?
It's definitely a really special feeling, right? It's a European golfer to be able to win in the European Tour this year and last year, and then as a Spanish player, to be able to win in Madrid, capital of Spain, the home golf course of the Spanish Golf Federation, that was very special. To be able to win Tiger's event, something that we all look up to, it's very special to just get an invite to play and to be able to win it is really, really special, as well as being able to win here in California, which apparently I like the state as a pro. We had 2-for-2 in California, so... hopefully I can keep it going this year.
It's a good stay, right? John Rahm joining us. You mentioned Tiger, and you won his tournament. You also beat him in Ryder Cup play last year, 2-1 in singles play. Can you take me back before that match? What was your reaction when you saw that you would be facing him in the singles? Then how'd you go about preparing for that round?
It was about 7 p.m., and I was in the player locker room waiting for my fiancée, Kelly, to come back from the merchandise stand, and they gave me the pin sheet, right? The pin sheet, the tee-off sheet. And I knew I was going to be fourth in line. So I see, I start looking down. First group, Rory, Justin Thomas, Second group, Paul Casey, Brooks, Justin Rose, Webb Simpson. And then I'm like, I knew Tiger in years past is like to tee off late because he can handle the pressure and he likes it. And when I see my name and I see TW right after that, I'm like, oh, right. He won last week. None of us have won a point yet that week. So I knew he was going to want to do it really, really badly. He was going to want to win it really, really badly. So it was going to, you know, be a battle to the death, because one of us was going to go undefeated unless we tied the match, right? So, sorry, one of them was going to be winningless that week. So it was going to be definitely much more than just losing a match, and at the same time to be against Tiger, extremely special, and to be able to clinch it out and with a birdie in one of the most difficult holes in the course, definitely a moment I won't forget.
Now, what a great story. Clones, it is time. It has never been easier to get life insurance than right now with SelectQuote. If you're like me and you've got a mortgage and a family who depends on your income, then you need to protect the ones you love with life insurance. Life insurance can pay off a mortgage or help send the kids to college. It's peace of mind. You think you can't afford it? Chances are SelectQuote can help you get it for less than a dollar a day. Here's an example. SelectQuote could find a 35-year-old man a $500,000 policy for under $19 a month, or a 37-year-old female a $750,000 policy for under $22 a month. That's less than a buck a day. A cup of coffee costs more than that. It's going to save you money. It's going to save you time. And yes, you want life insurance. It's important. If you pass, life insurance is your income replacement. It can help your spouse or partner pay off the mortgage or pay for college. Let SelectQuote save you time and money. Get your free quote at SelectQuote.com/Rome today. Again, SelectQuote.com/Rome for your free quote. Do not put off protecting your family for even one more day. SelectQuote.com/Rome. Get full details on the example policy at SelectQuote.com/commercials. Your premium could vary depending on your health, issuing company, and other factors. Not available in all states. John Rahm joining us. So one more thought about that. You grew up watching him, and then you're facing him in the Ryder Cup, and not only that, you beat him. So what's the moment like after the match when you shake hands with him?
Well, after I had that explosion of emotion, of celebration come out, I turned around and I saw he was coming towards me, right, as when I took my hat, and the first thing I had to do was apologize, because I feel bad. I mean, it is Tiger Woods. I have a great deal of respect towards Tiger as a golfer and as a person, so I apologized. He said, I mean, man, you deserved it. You played great all day. And I made sure I let him know what an honor that was for me. I'm sure he's heard that before, but I kind of have to get it out of my chest. And right after that, I started crying. You know, tears coming down my eyes, and then I saw my teammates, my family. My dad was crying as well. Kelly was more excited than anything. She was very, very pumped as an athlete. She understands what something like that means. So a lot of emotion. It was the first full point for Europe, which definitely shifted the momentum for the U.S., right, because they had a lot going on early on, and being able to get a good point and get into 11.5 was definitely a big, big thing. So it was extremely special, but, you know, I did cry for a little while.
PGA Tour Pro John Rahm joining us. You know, John, you mentioned your dad. I'm glad you did, because if I look at your career at Arizona State, if we go back a little bit, a lot of people know about you as a golfer, but some do not know how impressive you are away from the course. Growing up in the Basque region, you were a very good golfer, but your father really wanted you to go to America. He wanted you to get a college degree. Why was that something that was so important to him?
You know, he got an education. My mom got an education. They were able to do a lot of things besides work, and he always told me, you know, John, there's 24 hours in a day, 8 are for sleeping, you got 16 hours during the day to go to class, play golf, and enjoy, right? So there's plenty of time if you organize yourself, and I always understood the importance of an education, but I think more than that, they just wanted me to go to college and enjoy it, because they knew how much fun they had in Spain, right? So it happened through multiple, you know, times in my career. He also pushed me to go to a golf academy in Madrid, which was going to make me able to play golf and practice more and become a better golfer. And then in the States, the way he put it, it was, you know, John, you should always go ahead and try. Just go and try. You go for a year. If you don't like it, you come back. You get your degree here in Spain. You keep playing golf. Worst thing is going to happen if you come back is that you learn English, which, you know, being Spanish, being able to speak Spanish and English is going to be a great thing for the future. And then I came. I loved it, and I stayed and graduated. I also promised them I was going to graduate, that I was not going to turn pro before finishing my degree. So despite the possible temptations after playing good as an amateur, but it was something I promised, something I wanted to do, and I'm really, really glad that I did it, because, you know, that process in college got me better prepared and more ready to become a professional golfer.
My guess is Jon Rahm. I guess we're glossing over one small thing, John. You touched on this. You had to learn English, all right? So to set the stage, you go to Arizona State. You didn't just barely squeeze by either, by the way. You got a 3.6 in your first semester, but you had to learn English at the same time. Exactly how did you go about doing that?
Well, when I hear this, I mean, people make it sound like my English was a lot worse than it was. Okay. Obviously, it's a lot better now, but it wasn't the best. Learning UK English, I was used to, you know, listening to that accent and the type of slang that they use in the UK, and then coming to the States and having to live in English is a completely different story, right? I can't get by like I do on the golf course, knowing the bare minimum. So it was a lot to learn. I also didn't have time because of my visa coming in late to do an official visit. I had no idea. I'd never been to the States before, so it was a lot more than just learning English, right? Learn the college, American college way of life. Had to learn everything, right? So, but when it comes to the language, I mean, it was a long process, right? If you told me, if you asked me a question like you've been doing right now, I have to translate word by word what it means, right? Translate it to Spanish, understand it, think what I want to say in Spanish, and then translate it to English and say it. So that could be a pretty long process. And quite frankly, I'm very shy when it comes to things like that. So a lot of times I would just say yes or no to whatever they asked me, even if it wasn't a yes or no question. So there was some rough times, but once my hearing got better, once my understanding of the language got better, about a month, 2 months into college, started getting better, and it was a little bit easier. It is kind of ironic that I did graduate getting my communications major after that. So. You know, there was a lot of moments where I definitely got in trouble just because I had no idea what I was being asked to do. It was just as simple as that. Even I believe my coach, Tim Mickelson, didn't think I was going to make it past the first few weeks. But I'm glad I proved him wrong.
Hey, listen, I'm always awed. I've done this a long, long time, John. I'm always awed by people who come on a show like this and do an interview in a second language. Now, is this one of those stories that kind of follows along with it? Or did Eminem and Kendrick Lamar actually help you with the language? Is that true?
Okay, I didn't learn grammar or how to speak English from that, okay? It's kind of hard to learn it from that. You're going to learn a lot of bad words and a lot of bad things to say. But what I learned, besides enjoying the music, what I learned by memorizing the lyrics was how to pronounce and enunciate in a faster pace and just how to learn how to pronounce some words. It was basically like an exercise, right? Like, you know, one of those tongue twisters that you learn in speaking classes. It was basically the same thing. I was sitting there trying to learn all these fast-paced songs, and at one point, I got it dialed in. So it just helped me carry on conversations in a faster pace. It definitely helped me when it came to public speaking. It was definitely a tool. It wasn't meant to be that. I was just thought it was cool to be able to learn the songs. And a couple of my teammates did it very easily. So it was just an enjoyable time to me. I enjoyed the process, and you know, without knowing, it was helping my English.
Right, so before I let you go, what about Tempe? I mean, you had so many things going on. You had to learn the language. You had to deal with the new country. I mean, so many different things to deal with. What about Tempe overall and the college experience? What was that like?
Oh, it was great. I mean, it was the greatest 4 years of my life. So you have no worries compared to this class schedule that I had in high school. I mean, because of our golf practice, right, we could only have class from 8 in the morning or 7:30 till noon and then after 6 p.m. So you couldn't really have that many classes. And then one thing I learned in college that I didn't know is I thought you had to have class every single day, right? My first year, I did it that way. I didn't know that's what I was used to, right? You're mandatory to go every single day, but I didn't know you could actually organize your classes around to actually maybe skip a couple of days. So for 3 years of my life, I never had class on Friday. And my last 2 years, I never had class on Friday or Monday. So my weekends were 4 days long, which makes college a lot more fun because you have 4 days to do whatever you want in practice. And, you know, Tempe is a great town. I mean, there is so many students in Arizona State. It's almost like a city. Bear in mind, I come from Barica, Spain, which is a town of 1,200 people on the best day in summer, right? So going to ASU that has 75,000 students, it's a little bit of a change.
It's incredible.
It was definitely a lot of fun, a lot of golf practice, a lot of time to enjoy with my teammates, a lot of things to do in Tempe. I highly recommend it if anybody's thinking of going to Arizona State.
And that's why your parents told you you got to go there and get a degree and get an education, because it's the best time. So last thought, John, you're going to defend this week at the La Quinta Country Club, the Desert Classic starting tomorrow. You had a great run at the Masters last year. What was it like the first time you stepped foot on Augusta? Do you remember what that first round was like?
Oh, my first round? Well, my first tee shot at Augusta National was a straight duck hook into the trees. So not right. The best, but I did get my par on the first hole. It's definitely a very special feeling driving down Magnolia Lane as a golfer for the first time. You know, Augusta National is somewhere where everybody wants to play. It's unique. It's definitely one of a kind, and it's something that you're only going to experience once. But even now, every time we go back to Augusta and you drive again, it just feels the same way. You know, you get that those goosebumps, you get those butterflies in the stomach, and all you want to do is just go and play golf. It's definitely a fun track. I know it's hard to get in, but if anybody has ever a chance, I would suggest dropping anything you have going on to go and play.
Let's talk about the Dallas Cowboys for a minute. The Dallas defense was not the only no-show on Saturday night in the Coliseum. In the aftermath of that ass-kicking that Sean McVay and the Rams put on America's old team, one dude was shockingly absent when reporters came around looking for a comment. Jera. If the Cowboys win, there isn't a reporter within 30 miles of the team that can't find Jera. But not Saturday night. No Cowboys victory, no Jera comment until yesterday. About 72 hours after Todd Gurley and CJ Anderson ran Dallas out of the Coliseum. Now, if you thought a little time between that loss and a live mic were going to give Jera some time to settle down, maybe a little clarity on what went down over the weekend, you'd be wrong. He waited less than a week to drop what's going to go down as the most preposterous statement of the entire offseason, and the offseason has not even technically started yet. And shocker of all shockers, it has to do with his head coach, Jason Garrett.
If Jason Garrett had been out on the market 2 weeks ago, he would have had 5 offers for head coaching. I know that.
How do you know that? I know that. You know that. I need to replay that quote so you can fully grasp the impact of what Jera just did and what Jera just said.
If Jason Garrett had been out on the market 2 weeks ago, he would have had 5 offers for head coaching. I know that.
You know that.
I know that.
Yeah, I don't know that. How do you know that? Jera saying that Jason Garrett would have had 5 head coaching offers if he were on the market, it really is one of the more ridiculous things I've ever heard, even from Jera. Hell, Triple G, Greg Williams, and his 4 just show up and sign the contract without interviewing head coaching offers? Thinks that Jera might be overvaluing his guy. Check this out. Cliff Kingsbury, Matt LaFleur, Bruce Arians, Adam Gase, my man, Freddie Kitchens. What do all 5 of these guys have in common? All offensive innovators that the rest of the NFL respects. Now, what does the Ginge have in common with those 5? Not much. Not much other than a job title. Again, if Mike McCarthy can't get a head coaching offer after winning a Super Bowl with Aaron Rodgers and having 8 seasons of 10 wins or more, how the hell is Jason Garrett going to get 5? If every GM and owner is taking a big swing to pair their quarterback with a guy who's going to make their offense elite, on what planet are teams lining up to fight for a guy who's had exactly 1 top 5 offense since he took over that team? If Jera really thinks that the rest of the league is just dying to get their hands on Jason Garrett, then this dude is even more out of touch than I thought he was. Listen, I put respect on the Cowboys. I respect what they did this season. The Ginge actually got that team turned around. After it looked like he was going to be clapping and gum-chewing his way out of a job by Thanksgiving, Jera did a nice job in getting Leighton Vander Esch. He's a stud. That gamble in drafting Jalen Smith paid off. That looks great. Hell, the Amari Cooper trade was a win. Moves like that make you forget that this is the same guy that ran Jimmy Johnson off. This is the same guy that actually wanted to pick Johnny Manziel and Paxton Lynch. But all of that added up to what? 10 wins in a whack NFC East and a nice season. Last I checked, nice seasons were not the goal in Big D. At least they shouldn't be. Super Bowl wins were, or at least they used to be. Jarrah's first words after watching Sean McVay stuff the Ginge in a locker was to praise him and then say that five other teams would have hired him this offseason if they could. You know what that means? All that means is he's setting Jace up for a nice, fat contract extension.
Fat?
Not a matter of if, but a matter of when. 10-win seasons aren't the end goal. They're the first step. And if Jarrah is serious about doing anything other than stacking cash and building his net worth, then he's got to take that blindfold off when it comes to his coaching staff. I mean, I really don't know who this guy's trying to convince when he says five other teams would have hired Jason Garrett. Obviously himself, because nobody else anywhere is buying that. Hell, even Garrett himself isn't buying that. And locking this guy up and thinking he's Jimmy Johnson and Tom Landry all rolled into one after a playoff win, a single playoff win this season, sends the locker room and the rest of the world the message. Message being, good is good enough. As usual, Jarrah is not about the ring. He's about making Jack. He's about building worth for his franchise. And he's about getting other people to look at him and talk about him. And he's about having a coach who will not push back or ask for any control or look to call the shots himself. No, Jarrah's going to do that himself. And if being able to mix in a playoff win every 10 years or so is possible with this guy, then great. Just don't look for these guys to be playing in a Super Bowl anytime soon or ever again. Not with Jarrah around. It's just not his goal. He hasn't been a Super Bowl champ since 1995, and there's no reason to think that he's going to get back anytime soon. Not when he operates like that. Not when being good is good enough. Tell me again, how many offers would this guy get in the open market?
He would have had five offers for head coaching.
Give me five teams that would have offered that guy a head coaching job. Give me three. Give me one not named Dallas.
I know that.
How do you know that? Seriously, how do you know that?
What do you mean?
How do you know that?
I know that.
How? Make 2019 the year of getting your financial house in order. Do it with Robinhood. It's a non-intimidating way for stock market newcomers to invest for the first time with true confidence. It's simple and intuitive, and there's a clear design with data presented in an easy-to-digest manner. Here's what I like best about it. Other brokerages charge up to $10 for every single trade, but Robinhood does not charge commission fees. You can trade stocks and keep all of your profits. Also, there are easy-to-understand charts and market data. You can place a trade in just four taps on your smartphone. And the Robinhood web platform also lets you check out stock collections and analyst ratings of buy, hold, and sell for every single stock. And you can learn by doing. Learn how to invest as you build your portfolio. Discover new stocks and track favorite companies with a personalized news feed. And there are custom notifications for price movements so you never miss the right moment to invest. And on top of all that, Robinhood is giving you a free stock like Apple or Ford or Sprint to help build your portfolio. Sign up at jimrome.robinhood.com. That's jimrome.robinhood.com. My guest is TJ Dillashaw. TJ, great to have you on. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you, TJ. So Wednesday night of fight week, let me start right there. You're going to step into the cage on Saturday night in Brooklyn. You're going to fight for Cejudo's flyweight belt. How is life for you like right now, and what has fight week been like?
Fight week's always busy, but I love fight week, man. Fight week's easy. You know, I'm used to doing a 12-week camp when I'm working out two or three times a day. Today, I just got to do some interviews, talk to lovely people like yourself, and show my smile, and then I just do a workout, you know? So physically, my days are a lot easier.
All right, so the fight itself, after Cejudo beat Demetrius Johnson, he called you out, and everybody would have understood if you said, hey, look, you want to fight me? You can come up to my weight and fight me, but that's not what you're doing. What is it about the challenge of dropping down that appeals to you?
So he called me out, and the fight was supposed to happen at 35. They asked him to come up to me at 135. He turned it down. He's scared to fight me. Once he turned it down, I said, all right, man, well, I'm coming to you. You can't call me out and not get beat up by me. So I told him I'm willing to drop down. And it's more beneficial for me. You know, I'm going to be one of these guys that makes a statement and stepping into my legacy. You know, because I'm going to get a second belt at 125, shut the division down, shoot, I'll go 145 and be the first three-division champion ever.
TJ Dillashaw joining us, quote, "You can't call me out and not get beat up," end of quote. Listen, everybody wants to talk about the weight cut. Everybody wants to. TJ, you know it's a good quote when I re-quote you right after you say it. Everybody wants to talk about the weight cut, but you said that it went very well, and you were actually surprised by it. What was that process like?
Well, the weight cut was done for the last 12 weeks. You know, as soon as I found out I was going 125s, I take my job very seriously. You know, everyone always going to ask, like, "Hey, when's the weight cut start? When's the weight cut start?" The weight cut's over. I've done the weight cut over the last 12 weeks. Now it's just some fight tricks and displacing some water and making the weight. So it's been an actually easier than I expected. I knew it was going to be a lot of work, but there's been no hiccups. My weights came down exactly how I was supposed to. Me and my strength conditioning coach, Sam Calavita, the science behind that guy and the brain behind him is amazing. I mean, he had a checklist every week. Most of those times, like, what I need to wake up at, what I need to wake up at. And I was reaching those marks early. And so my body responded great. My strength went up. I'm stronger than I was in my last camp. And I'm lighter than I was in my last camp. So my power output, my strength-to-weight ratio is insane. I'm excited to show it off.
TJ Dillashaw joining us. So if that's what it did for you physically and you actually feel stronger, to do something like that and not have to drop that weight at the last second, but to do it the right way, mentally, what's that do for you?
Oh, it's everything. It's so important because I know that I can push the pace the entire fight. I can break him. And it's not that I feel stronger than last time. I am. I put up my own PRs, you know, my own personal records of snatch and press, my clean and press. I put up all my PRs fight. So I guess it's not bro science. I'm not like, "Yeah, man, I think I feel better." It's like, "No, I know I feel better. The numbers don't lie. My cardiac output is better. My lactate threshold is better. My resting heart rate is better." But it's because of how much work I've had to put in to do this. You know, I didn't cut any corners.
We're talking to TJ Dillashaw, big fight coming up. Now, Cejudo, not as impressed. He said that he saw pictures of you, TJ, and said you look like, quote, Pee Wee Herman. He said, quote, "He's not looking so well. He looks like he needs a cup of water. He looks like a cross-country runner," end of quote. I don't know if you heard that or not, but now that you have, what's your reaction to that? What do you make of that?
The only reason why I've heard is because of doing interviews like you guys. You know, you guys come in and says, "Pee Wee Herman's looking good, man. He's got a nice little fresh suit on. Oh, he's looking good." Him saying I need a drink of water is hilarious because I'm actually 66% hydrated. Which is the average person is usually in the low 50s, you know. So my cells are absorbing water. I'm overhydrated. I'm ready to flush that last little bit of water weight. And he's just trying to create something to give himself some confidence because he knows I'm going to come in there and be a ridiculous threat to him never being a champion.
I love that. Pee Wee Herman is a good-looking dude with a sweet suit, and if anything, I'm overhydrated.
He's always dressed to the nines, you know? He's got that nice suit on. He's got the sweet dance moves. My dad was always he was like Pee Wee Herman Halloween outfits, so it's just funny to me to hear that again. I've heard the name Pee Wee Herman in forever.
He is always dressed to the nines. He's part of the bow tie revolution. Yeah. You're right, man. We should all have that look.
Exactly.
You know, you've said that you're addicted to getting better. What is it that drives you and motivates you to want to get better all the time? Like, what's that addiction about? Where does the drive come from?
Man, it's something I was raised with. You know, my dad's my hero. Really, he's instilled in me the hard work, the work ethic that I have in myself. Watching him as I was growing up, always working his butt off, blue collar man, feeding his family. He's instilled the work ethic in me, and then me just setting goals of being the greatest of all time. You know, like, how am I going to be the greatest of all time if I'm not always getting better? You know, because the guys in this sport are getting better. Those guys that are making gains, I have a target on my back, and I want to always be ahead of them, one step ahead.
All right, so I can't let you go without a prediction. How do you see this thing going, and then how do you see it ending?
I'm finishing him. That's for sure. I'm going to finish this fight. He's going to fold. He's not going to handle my pressure. He's going to hand that belt over to me. It's one of those things that, like, as soon as that cage door locks, he made a mistake by calling me out. And I don't think he understands how big a mistake it is because he's going to feel that pressure and just want to give up. And I'll finish him this fight.
TJ Dillashaw, UFC Bantamweight Champion. And again, that fight is UFC Fight Night 143. It is Saturday night. It is live from Brooklyn. TJ, good to get caught up and visit with you again, man. Thank you so much. Good luck this weekend. Hope we can talk soon.
Absolutely, man. We'll definitely be talking soon. I got a gold belt on my shoulder. I really appreciate you having me on.
If you need auto parts but you cannot get to the store just yet, simply head on over to O'ReillyAuto.com. You can buy your parts online and then pick them up in any of the 4,500 O'Reilly Auto Parts stores nationwide. No shipping costs, easy returns, and convenient pickup on your schedule. Shop your way for the parts you need at O'ReillyAuto.com. O'Reilly Auto Parts, better parts, better prices every day. We're going to talk about something that I never wanted to talk about ever again. A topic that I never wanted to get into ever again. Larry Nassar. You remember that, right? You remember that name, Larry Nassar. You know, I don't even know the word to describe a guy like that. I mean, I can, but not here. A monster. This guy was a monster who used his position as a doctor for Michigan State and USA Gymnastics to sexually assault hundreds of people. Yeah, well, he's back in the news. Actually, he's not back in the news. Michigan State interim president John Engler is back in the news, and for all the wrong reasons. Engler took over last year after the previous president, Luana Simon, resigned in disgrace hours after Nassar was sentenced. Engler has seemed to go out of his way to do everything he could to make sure that he goes out in that same disgrace. Here are a few of the highlights from the Detroit Free Press. There was the move to cancel a $10 million healing fund for counseling for Nassar survivors. There was Engler's accusation that the first survivor to come forward was getting kickbacks from attorneys. There was another survivor who said that Engler offered her $250,000 to drop her lawsuit. And the list goes on. But let me fast forward to the latest, which was when Engler told the Detroit News last week that there are some Nassar survivors, quote, who have been in the spotlight, who are still enjoying that moment at times, you know, the awards and recognition, end quote. I'm sorry, but did this guy just say that people who were sexually assaulted by a convicted pedophile are, quote, enjoying the spotlight? And quote, you know, the awards and recognition, end quote. In a world of horrible takes, that might be the worst ever. Seriously, you're talking about women who needed medical attention and were sexually assaulted by the doctor who was supposed to provide it, and they're, quote, enjoying the spotlight. What the hell is wrong with you? What the hell is wrong with you? And this is coming from a guy who said that when he took over, he would leave the school as, quote, if my own daughter were on this campus, end quote. Thanks for nothing, loser. Yeah, but don't take it from me. Ask Rachel Denhollander, the first survivor to come forward. Ask her what she thinks. She tweets, quote, Engler references survivors enjoying their time in the spotlight. You mean like having to change the day I grocery shop so my three kids don't see a photo of their mom demonstrating what was done to her body? Tell me more about how enjoyable this spotlight is. End quote. Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and say that nobody was looking to be in the spotlight and absolutely nobody is enjoying, quote, you know, the awards and the recognition. Like when you say that to yourself, you're really telling us about yourself. You're really saying that you enjoy awards and recognition and that it would be something that motivates you to do something. This is the interim school president who followed a school president who mismanaged the situation and then claimed that it was politicized. And yet somehow you managed to make it even worse. I mean, it takes a hell of a lot of work to see what Luana Simon did and then come close to being as terrible at this as her, if not even worse. No wonder news broke this morning that the Michigan State University Board of Trustees is going to meet tomorrow to debate his future. I'm going to go ahead and say that it's going to be a really short debate. No wonder one member of that board declared, John Engler's reign of terror is over. Michigan State University will be returned to the people. You know, my only question is, what the hell took so long? But you know what, though? Don't make it about this guy. And don't get me wrong. Him being fired or forced to resign is a great thing. And it shouldn't happen tomorrow. It should have happened a long time ago. But let's go ahead and learn from what this guy did, how he handled it, and never repeat those same mistakes. But understand this, Engler is not the story here. If you want to remember something from the story, remember the survivors. Remember the 168 individuals who gave impact statements at Nassar's trial. Remember their families. Remember the ones who have not yet come forward. Remember their families too. The Nassar survivors are incredible. They did not seek out the spotlight. They knew they'd be in the spotlight, and they knew it would be painful and ugly and horrible. But they did it anyway because they wanted to make sure that this monster got the justice that he deserved. So the pain that they suffered and the courage that they showed will endure. Remember them. We are joined by Julian Love. Julian, really nice to have you on. How are you?
Doing all right. How are you, Jim?
I'm doing great. Doing great. Nice to visit with you. Let me ask you first, you had a huge season at Notre Dame. You could have come back for another season. So what was the decision-making process like for you? And ultimately, what made you decide that this was the right time to come out?
Yeah, I mean, it was extremely tough. You know, I love Notre Dame. I'm from Chicago. So I grew up a Notre Dame fan, and I just loved everything about the university. And I have the past 3 years. At the end of the day, I had to think about it in terms of, you know, my body and the business decision. I've played every single game since I've been at Notre Dame. So it's 38 total. I started 34 of those. And, you know, I had to realize that I played a lot of football. And so NFL has kind of seen everything that I have. You know, they've seen a lot of film. And so I thought it was the right time to prepare for the draft and just really take my chance now.
Julian Love joining us. It's a great explanation. Let me take you back a little bit. When you were growing up and you were playing flag football for the Longhorns outside of Chicago back in the day, what were you like as a player at that point?
Well, I mean, in a lot of ways, it's similar to how I am now. I really just played for fun. I had, I got so many good relationships back then and developed great bonds with a lot of people, a lot of families. I still talk to a lot of them today, and I think that's what the game has been for me, just to really run around with my best friends every day and just have fun, really. And that's what it was like back when I was a Longhorn in Portage Park, and it's how it is now.
Julian Love joining us. At the same time, you were really analytical, even as a young kid. Your father, DT, talks about how he and your mother knew that you had something special about you when you were 8 years old and you were breaking down film of your rival team, the Razorbacks. What do you remember about that?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's all a credit to my mom. She recorded every single game, you know, just to really keep the memories at first. And so she recorded every type of event that my brother and my sister did. And, you know, that after every game, I would then go plug in the camcorder into the TV and really just watch the game over again, watch what's coming up, watching what happened, what I saw. And it really gave me perspective early on. To, you know, a different line of view, something that I could have missed, something that, you know, I saw and did correctly. And I just did it because I just loved watching film, really, at a young age. And now that really has enhanced my game because I feel like I know how to watch film just because I've been doing it since I was 7 years old.
We're talking to Julian Love. You know, I'll get back to that in a minute. But you played your high school ball at Nazareth Academy, and there's no denying that you were good. You were definitely good. But some Power mm-hmm. 5 schools were a little bit cautious about you, maybe because they had concerns about your size. What was the recruiting process like?
Thinking back, you know, it was tough at first. I didn't go to a big school. I went to a co-ed school of 800 kids, predominantly not good at football, the school was. And, you know, I did well. You know, I was on varsity my sophomore year, competed very well. And, you know, a lot of the big schools in the area, which are mostly Big Ten schools, weren't, you know, really interested. They were curious, you know, on my competition that I'm playing, my size, my speed, a lot of things. And it really took one school to take the chance, and that was Illinois early on, to get the ball rolling. Then other schools kind of went. And once they came in and saw me and talked to me, they kind of realized what I was about and then that's when more offers came. It was tough, though. It was really tough at first, and seeing a lot of my friends who I thought I was better than them, I could compete with, getting a lot more offers than me because, you know, size or speed, and it was tough early on, but it all worked out, so I'm happy.
Julian Love joining us. It certainly did work out. Now, your father was always a huge, huge Notre Dame fan. The debate as to whether or not he had any tears in his eyes when you committed to ND, set the record straight. Were there any tears? Did it get dusty for a minute?
Yeah, BK offered. I committed on the spot, and my mom cried, and I believe my dad did shed some tears. they're both there. They're both very emotional. So that's definitely on the record that he cried.
All right. So then, knowing your history with the school, knowing how much it meant to everybody in the family, I've got to know, what was it like for you and your family when you ran out of that tunnel in a gold helmet for the first time?
It was unbelievable. I mean, as everything I dreamed it would be. Every single game running out of that tunnel, I took a second to just look around to see and cherish everyone there, and, you know, all the fans and my family, my friends, who really just supported me. And, you know, to this day, to my very last game, I really just enjoyed every single moment in that stadium because it's just such a special place and a place that I grew up to love, really.
We're talking to Julian Love. He's getting ready for the NFL draft. You know, going back to that notion of you doing film work starting at the age of 7, you know, the reoccurring theme from analysts and coaches and people around you know that you don't just make plays based on natural ability. Certainly there's that, but also on your ability to know what seems like it's going to happen before it actually does happen. So, like, how does that play out? When you're on the field and you see a formation or a play starting to develop that you know what's going to happen, how does that feel? What's that like?
I mean, it feels pretty good, you know, when you feel that key or that read is happening, that you've studied for, that you've been waiting for. I like to choose about 3 to 5, you know, instances of quarterback reads, you know, tackle sets, of certain things that I know a play is coming. I like to pick up on a few of them, and I basically wait until they happen, and I be aggressive. Part of that is just being confident. I think when you're confident in anything you do, you perform better. I mean, you're willing to take chances, and that's kind of how I have done, really. It's been great.
I like that. How much of that, for instance, the work that you do in the film room, how much of it is about looking at big picture stuff like formations? And then how much of that is about looking at little things like tendencies or weight shifts that a receiver might have that tips you off to what he's going to do?
Right. I think, you know, in college, a lot of it is focused on the big picture stuff, you know, formations, concepts, you know, routes. I think it's that, but I then, when we watch film, I'm huge on like little tendencies and little things, which every player is like, you know, what how many steps are doing to take a certain route, and little things like that is kind of what I get that's my bread and butter right there, and I think that's what led to my success, just really being intentional about the little details in film.
Got another moment or so with Julian Love. He's getting ready for the NFL draft. Now, your high school coach at Nazareth Academy used to tell you the game is a mousetrap and all the distractions are cheese as you're getting ready for the NFL draft. What now is the mousetrap and what's the cheese? How do you go about focusing on things that matter?
Yeah, it's tough. I think, you know, the cheese is, you know, you're focusing on endorsements, you know, you're starting to have a little money in your pocket. You know, it's all the things you could be doing. When in essence, all that matters is just playing some football, just training, getting your body at its peak shape to compete and to show these coaches kind of what I'm about. And I think, I mean, that's a tough mousetrap for a lot of guys at this age. You know, you come out of college where you essentially had no money ever, and to a matter in a month, you know, you'll have more money than you know what to do with. I think that's a big trap for a lot of guys. But I called my high school coach, and he told me to put the cheese in the freezer and hold off
great.
On it until the time is right.
That's great. And it is hard because if you've never had really anything and all of a sudden you have it all at once, number one, you can't really have any value for it because there's no perspective. And number two, you're probably telling yourself, I earned this, I deserve this, but you got to be careful with it. So finally, what about the combine? How do you approach that? I mean, that is so different than anything you've ever done, right? It's like the biggest job interview ever, but they're measuring just numbers. How do you approach that part of the process?
Yeah, it's definitely tough. I mean, I'm still trying to get a feel for it, but it's essentially a bunch of football players preparing for a track competition physically, in terms of our running, our sprints, and a lot of non-football related drills, in my opinion. To then being in a, you know, interview business setting, like in
like you're interviewing for a job. And so it's a lot of things thrown at you, really, that you have to train for those specific things. You can't just train like, all right, you're good at football, let's go out there and do what you do. You really have to train for these events and for this interview process, for the medical evaluations. It's a lot thrown at you, and that's supposed to throw you off. But as long as you guys stay cool, calm, and collected, everything should be great.
Knowing the way you approach it, you're not going to wing it. And, Julian, I think you've got the interview portion down. You don't have to worry about that. The draft is coming up April 25th through the 27th in Nashville. Julian Love, my guest. Julian, great to have you on the show. Good luck with that. Have fun with that. And I hope we can talk again once you make it to the NFL.
Yes, of course. Thank you. I appreciate it.
He's back for redemption quickly. Let's go to the Natty. Steve. Hey, Steve, how are you? What's up?
I wanted to call back after Al ran me out of town yesterday like Rick Pitino. I got a question. If you are the...
That's not a good call. No. You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
Hey, Steve. Yesterday, he may have run you unfairly. Today, he left you on too long. Chiefs fan, where the hell are you? Here's one. Let's go to Wichita. Earl, good to have you, Earl. What's up? How are you?
Well, if I live to be 100, I will never forget the first AFC championship at Arrowhead. You might not believe it, but the world missed Tom Brady in a Super Bowl. I love football, especially this time of year when it's running smoothly. I don't know what we would have done without Mahomes. What? You don't know Patrick Mahomes? Well, pull up an ice block and let me tell you. You know Elway and Montana, Unitas and Namath. But do you know the most famous quarterback of all? Patrick the Frog Voice QB, croaking out signals at Arrowhead, beating up on the Colts and busting Brady's heads. All of the other teams passed on him in the draft. They watched him win the Super Bowl and suffered from their gaffe. Chiefs are going to win 32-24, and Greg Williams can't take our head, Jim, because...
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
Did you just sing your prediction to Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer? Now, this gal, she's familiar with the podcast. She is familiar with the voicemail. In fact, she's a legend of the voicemail, and she's come off the voicemail to come on the show. Andy in Rockland. Andy, what's up? How are you?
Hey, Jim. How are you?
Good, Andy. How are you?
Good, thank you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Okay, so I heard you guys talking about John Denver, and I actually saw his plane crash into the Monterey Bay.
You did?
Yeah, this is a true story.
When it happened?
Okay, so my parents have a house, beach house, down in Pacific Grove, and I was driving down there, and I was right on the freeway next to the water, and I saw a little white plane crash into the water. So then when I got to my parents' house, I told them, and we turned on the news, and then we found on Denver, and then my dad said, maybe he was on the Rocky Mountain High.
Your dad said that.
My dad said that. Yeah, he's very conservative.
All right. But, so, like, when you saw that plane go down, Andy, what was your reaction? Did you think, like, did I just see that? Or what did you do? What did you think?
I was shocked. And because where I was, the Monterey Bay Airport was right kind of near where I was. Hmm. But I had no idea it was John Denver.
How could you? How could you?
I thought I'd share the story.
All right, Andy, thank you very much. See you on the podcast.
Good night now!